The Persian poet and religious leader, known to most of the world as Rumi, was an Islamic mystic who lived in the 13th century. He's often credited with being the father of the whirling dervishes, whom some of you might be familiar with, these practitioners of a mystical Islamic tradition known as Sufism. And the whirling dervishes, instead of praying silently on their knees, pray in the rhythm of a dance until the whirling and the cosmos become one. And the man who dances, or the woman who dances, becomes one with that rhythm which moves us all. There's a story about how Rumi, this much beloved spiritual teacher, came to choose the path that he would follow for the whole rest of his life. It begins, as do most stories of the great mystical traditions of the world, with a wandering teacher who went from town to town and city to city. This particular teacher was named Shams, and Shams had a problem. In that every time he went to a new place, all the people that he taught to and all the people that he spent time with started eventually to only follow him instead of follow the beloved that he believed his teaching was pointing to. Every time he showed up in a town, people would decide, "Oh, Shams, you great wise man, you have all the answers." And every time that happened, Shams was headed out of town. He wouldn't say goodbye. He wouldn't give a peep to the people that he had been working with. As soon as they began to hold him as more beloved than the great beloved to which he pointed, he hightailed it out of town. So it just so happened that one time Shams was on one of his very regular trips to a new town, escaping the adulation of the masses. What a thing that must be. And he walked in to a little town called Konya in what is now Afghanistan. And sitting there next to the village fountain was a young man who sat quietly, peacefully reading a sacred book. The young man had singular focus. His attention was unwavering. For indeed, the words he read were the words of the sages of his fathers and his father's fathers. They were windows into the very mind of God. Without hesitation, Shams emerged from the midst of the big, crowded square. He grabbed a hold of the sacred book that the young man was reading, and he threw it, tumbling end over end, into the water of the fountain. The young man, of course, torn from his quiet reveries reading, he stood up. Of course, he was angry at first. He feared that this sacred book was lost to him. And Shams, being the wise old wandering sage, always at risk of having too much adulation, must do some pretty amazing things. So Shams, in this case, reached into the fountain, pulled out that sacred book, completely unharmed and untouched by the water, and offered it to the young scholar whose name was Rumi, along with a choice. The choice was simple, he said. Rumi could reach out for the book and continue with a worthy life, a life in which he would strive to encounter the sacred through scholarship and study. He could grapple with the meaning of those holy words in that one book for his whole life. Or, said Shams, he could choose a different path. He could walk away from the scholar's thoughtful pursuits and the reasonable arguments of the academy and choose simply to experience God in the world around him. He could choose the book or he could choose life itself. As you might guess, Rumi chose the latter path. And instead of reading and studying his way to God, he chose instead to dance his way to God. And dance he did. A dance of love and ecstasy that Sufi mystics are dancing still. Rumi came to understand that the point of being a spiritual person was not to know the answers to all of his questions, but to live in the presence of a love so vast that it transformed everything around him into God. not learning about God, but living inundated by God. That became his mission. He was, in essence, a troubadour of passion. He was a devotee who lived only to praise the object of his devotion. But like the other great mystics of all religious traditions, the object of his devotion was nothing so simple as a man or a woman or a great big guy in the sky ready to judge you. Instead, his love was for him with a capital H. It was dedicated to the One with a capital O. It was poured out to the big She, the mother of all mothers, to whom he sang his praise and into whose warm bosom he sank in his sorrows. Like all mystics, Rumi was not primarily a theologian. He was first and foremost a lover, and his beloved, even when it did wear the face or garb of a man or a woman or a squirrel or a sunset, his beloved was always God. Every man was God, every woman was God, every squirrel was God's sense of humor, and every sunset was God's bright hair streaming across the firmament. All of it was God, and all of it was the object of his devotion. He was a lover, and his beloved was always close at hand. Now this understanding, this encompassing aspect of the divine, the idea that everything is holy and that one simply has to call the face of God the beloved other. This idea is the hallmark of all Sufi mysticism, and I know that realists and cynics as we are, that people confronting often the darkness and pain of this world, I know that it stretches the mind to imagine such an approach. But that is what Rumi believed. That is how he lived. And I ask not whether that approach is correct, but only this: what would such a way of life do to you? There is, in essence, to a mystic, no effort to find God at all, but only the effort to love what presents itself before your eyes. To love. To love. One Sufi mystic, Kabir, who always had such a sense of humor, captured the ever-present sense of the holy and our sometime failure to understand that we are surrounded by it when he said, "The fish in the water who is thirsty needs serious professional counseling." To the Sufis, the very water in which we swim is God, and every moment is, or at least can be, an experience of divine revelation. The world is cracked open, and if one could see it with a lover's eyes, there would be no end to the beauty we might encounter. Of course, the Sufis don't have a corner on this market. In college, I spent a lot of time studying the lives of all things, female mystics in 16th century Spain, which was at the time of the Spanish Inquisition. These Christian women, whose tangible work in the world was to found convents and take in unwed mothers and orphan children, they were hunted down, in most cases by church authorities, because they dared to speak of God not as an abstraction that they could only touch through the work of a priest or a church, but dared to speak of God as a lover who came to them in the midst of their troubles, spoke to them from the midst of the mundane, and lifted them out of darkness and into hope. They dared to speak of God as a lover who gave them joy and who filled their hearts with light, not as a judge who meted out the relative punishments for unfit people. And most of all, they dared to truly love their God. Most of those women died, going to their last moments unwilling to deny the power of that love and the truth of it. Like Rumi, female mystics in the Christian tradition and others from nearly every tradition find a way to choose the second path, not the studied intellectualization of faith, but the lived experience of loving God. And like Rumi, there was no turning back for them once such a decision had been made. They had chosen devotion over rationalization, experience over belief, and such devotion is not an easy thing to walk away from. I sometimes describe the universalist half of our Unitarian Universalist tradition as the more devotional side of our family. Whereas the Unitarian half is certainly the more intellectual tradition of the two. And by devotional, I mean to say that our Universalist side, the history of it and the heritage of it, calls us to experience God, to experience love of the holy, more than thinking about it. Devotionalism, whether on the part of our own religious predecessors or women in 16th century Spain or Sufi mystics in Persia, devotionalism, experience of the holy, can take a lot of forms. It may, in fact, be a very personal, very private experience. A private experience of the relationship that only you know. It is religion without mediator or veil. It is an experience of God understandable and nameable only to you and knowable only in the privacy of your heart. It involves loving in the unique way that only you can love, and it is, in essence, intimacy with all that is holy. This intimacy, this devotion, it can involve prayer. It can involve the simple awe of being in and among the natural world. In fact, the Sufis taught us every single thing in the world has potential to be devotional practice. Devotion can be the quiet silence of a new morning. It can be the rapturous transport of music. It can be the simple joy of love given and received in relationship to another person just as flawed and fabulous as yourself. It can certainly involve dancing or poetry or art. Everything we do, from mowing the lawn to making lemonade, can be seen as an experience of the holy and an opportunity to praise the beloved source from which all grass and all lemonade comes. Everything, to a person who practices a devotional life, can be an opportunity to fall in love all over again. Perhaps the greatest female Sufi poet who ever lived, Rabia, wrote of he with a capital H when she talked of the object of her devotion. She said, "Why is it that we think of God so much? Why is there so much talk about love? When an animal is wounded, no one has to tell it you need to heal, so naturally it will nurse itself as best it can. My eye kept telling me something is missing from all I see. So I went in search of the cure. The cure for me was his beauty, the remedy to all my brokenness. For me was to love." Devotion, pure and simple, is the experience of love. That experience can in fact come to stand in the place of doctrinal teaching, even in the place of discernible theology or an accurate statement of what you believe. It can be the primary way a person experiences the sacred, and you don't necessarily need a church to experience it, though at our best, we church folks just try to stay out of its way. If we view the world with eyes of devotion, perhaps it does not matter what you believe as much as what you love. Perhaps it does not matter what your religion tells you, but what your heart tells you. We spend so much time trying to discern what we believe and how and why with the twisting, turning courses of our logic. What if we're just called to be in the presence of our love and to let that love make us better and more compassionate people? To feel rather than to know, and to understand that the feeling is just as real as the knowing ever was. Sufi mystics like the old traveler in our story this morning teach that God is everywhere. There is nowhere one can point one's feet that will not be in the direction of something sacred. Nowhere one can cast one's gaze that will not fall upon the holy. If God is everywhere, then the object of your love, that which you are devoted to, whatever and whomever that might be, is holiness itself. And you don't need to spend all day thinking about whether you are a rational humanist or a scientific atheist or an intellectual theist or an anti-Trinitarian Calvinist with a surprisingly appealing theology of atonement. It doesn't matter. All you have to do is love what you love. That is the essence the mystics teach us of the spiritual life. Nothing deeper than that. Love what you love. And allow that love to seep out of you and into the world and all its aspects. Love what you love and let that love change the world. You can kill to defend a doctrine, but can you kill in defense of a God who is everywhere, in everything, in every person, including the one trembling with fear at the point of your knife? People will kill for their intellectual construct of God, but it is much harder and much more complicated to kill for the object of your undying devotion. There are no orthodoxies in love, no doctrines in devotion. There is only the experience, and that experience doesn't need a good definition. Baruch Spinoza once said, and I've told you this quote before because I love it, God resembles our words about as much as the dog star resembles a dog. Namely, not at all. And yet we spend whole lifetimes grappling with, running away from, and returning to the age-old questions that have followed at the heels of religious people since the first woman looked up at the first stars and wondered why they sparkled so. There are questions of truth with a capital T, questions of origins and meanings and proofs or lack thereof of God's existence. There are entire sections of college bookstores dedicated to something called systematic theology, a pursuit that has worn more than one seminarian down to a hard little nib of frustration in its circling attempts to define exactly what one should and should not believe about the deity and human nature and religious belief. There are doctrines and there are creeds and there are endless words for the mystery that holds us, all of which resemble the source of life about as much as the dog star resembles a dog, namely, not at all. In the words, once again, of Sufi poet Rabia, since no one really knows anything about God, those who think they do are just troublemakers. And so just for today, perhaps because we are under the spell of the mystics, let us consider love, devotion, and intimacy with all that is holy. Let us consider what it would be like to let go of our struggle to define and capture the precise measure of our belief and disbelief, and give thought instead, just for today, to throwing the book back in the fountain and striding out into this new day, ready to fall in love all over again. I conclude with quotes from those who lived a life of love, ones who fell in love and never turned away. Why look like a dead fish in this ocean of God? Rumi. You might quiet the whole world for a second if you pray. And if you love, really love, our guns will wilt. St. John of the Cross. Love is the perfect stillness and the greatest excitement and the most profound act, and the word almost as complete as his name, Rabia. On a day when the wind is perfect, the sail just needs to open, and the love starts. Today is such a day. Rumi.